Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Silvercrest Earnings Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone to reach an operator. As a reminder, this conference call may be recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Richard Hough, Chief Executive Officer and President. Please proceed.
Thank you for joining us today for Silvercrest Asset Management Group's fourth quarter and year-end 2013 results. Silvercrest has once again experienced strong growth in assets under management for the 12 months ended December 31st, 2013, and we also experienced strong revenue growth in the three-month period ending December 31st, 2013. As of December 31st, 2013, our assets under management rose to $15.7 billion. That is up $1.1 billion from $14.6 billion as of September 30th, 2013. This was due to very strong organic growth, investment performance, and new institutional business. We're pleased with these results as it shows continuing progress with our growth plan, particularly in our institutional business. In addition, as many of you know, our founder and CEO, Moffett Cochrane, died on November 18th during the quarter. Thanks to the support of the board and my partners, we have made an effective transition in management, and the company is executing the business plan as we have discussed with investors in the past. I appreciate the support that we've heard from investors and clients alike. With that, I turn this over to Scott Gerard for comments about our financials, and I'll be available for questions following that discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. As we stated in our earnings release for the fourth quarter and year-end, AUM as of December 31st, 2013, was $15.7 billion. Revenue for the quarter was $17.2 million, and reported consolidated net income for the quarter was $4.1 million. As a reminder, similar to what I discussed on the previous quarter's call, please keep in mind the results of operations and cash flows for the year ended December 31st includes 6 months of results of operations and cash flows of our accounting predecessor, Silvercrest LP. Also, commencing with the third quarter, we began reporting earnings attributable to Silvercrest Asset Management Group, Inc., which represents our Class A shareholders. Also, in the third quarter, we started reflecting partner incentive payment accruals as compensation expense. Historically, these incentive payments were recorded as distributions when paid and rolled up in equity and bypassed the P&L. For some commentary on the fourth quarter, revenue for the fourth quarter of this year was $17.7 million, representing approximately a 21% increase over revenue of $14.1 million for the same period last year. This increase was driven primarily by growth in management and advisory fees as a result of increased AUM. Expenses for the quarter were $15.4 million, representing approximately a 52% increase over expenses of $10.2 million for the same period last year. This increase was primarily attributable to increases in compensation and benefits expense of $6.1 million, partially offset by a decrease in general and administrative expenses of about $900,000. The increase in compensation and benefits expense was primarily attributable to an increase in the accrual for bonuses of $5.1 million related to the commencement, again, of expensing partner incentive payments, as I previously mentioned. Also, included in compensation and benefits expense for the quarter is approximately $200,000 of additional equity-based compensation expense related to the acceleration of the vesting of deferred equity units of our former chief executive officer. Upon his death, these deferred equity units accelerated. General and administrative expenses decreased primarily as a result of the fact that in the fourth quarter of 2012, we had to expense IPO-related fees related to the S-1 process when we withdrew it back in November of 2012. Those expenses had to be run through the P&L. Reported consolidated net income was $4 million for the quarter as compared to $5.7 million in the same period last year. Reported net income for the fourth quarter last year, again, does not include the effect of partner incentive payments. Reported net income attributable to Silvercrest, which represents the Class A shareholders, for the fourth quarter of this year was $2 million, or 32 cents per basic and diluted Class A share. Adjusted EBITDA, which we define as EBITDA without giving effect to equity-based compensation expense and non-recurring items, but does include the effect of partner incentive payments, was $4.5 million, or 26.3% of revenue for the quarter, compared to $4 million, or 28.9% of revenue for the same period last year. Adjusted net income, which we define as net income without giving effect to non-recurring items, but includes both partner incentive payment expense and income tax expense, assuming a 40% corporate tax rate, was $1.9 million for the quarter, or 16 cents per adjusted basic share and 15 cents per adjusted diluted share. The adjusted earnings per share information, that equals adjusted net income divided by the actual Class A and Class B shares outstanding as of the end of the reporting period. For basic shares outstanding and to the extent dilutive, we add unvested deferred equity units and performance units to the total shares outstanding. With respect to the full year, revenue for the year was $60.1 million, representing approximately a 16% increase over revenue of $51.7 million for the same period last year. This increase also was driven by increases in management advisory fees as AUM increased during the same period. Expenses for the year were $43.5 million, representing approximately a 33% increase over expenses of $32.8 million for the same period last year. Again, this increase is primarily attributable to higher compensation expense of $11.2 million, partially offset by a decrease in general and administrative expense of approximately $500,000. Again, the increase in compensation expense is primarily because of the inclusion of partner incentive payments, in addition to the fact that as recognition of our initial public offering, we made bonus payments to non-principal employees of approximately $750,000 back in July of 2013. Also, equity-based compensation expenses increased approximately $800,000 as a result of an increase in the fair value of our previously issued deferred equity units. With respect to recurring cash compensation expense for 2013, the ratio was approximately 55% of revenue. General and administrative expenses, again, decreased from last year, you know, primarily because of the IPO expenses that needed to be recognized in the fourth quarter of 2012. This was partially offset by a $780,000 charge for payments to be made through November of 2014 to a relative of our former chief executive officer. Also, occupancy expense increased approximately $700,000 as a result of reoccupying our space at our headquarters. Reported net income was $17.2 million for 2013 as compared to $19.7 million in the same period last year. Reported net income attributable to Silvercrest or the Class A shareholders for the year was $13.7 million, or $1.68 per basic outstanding share and $1.63 per diluted share. Again, the weighted average shares and units for the year end includes the weighting of units outstanding on a converted basis as of the completion of our IPO, in addition to the Class A shares outstanding for the 6 months ended December 31st of 2013. Adjusted EBITDA was $17.3 million, or approximately 29% of revenue for 2013, compared to $14.7 million, or 28% of revenue for the same period last year. Adjusted net income was $7.7 million for the year ended 2013, or 64 cents per adjusted diluted per adjusted basic share, and 62 cents per adjusted diluted share. With respect to our Balance sheet total assets were $100.7 million as of December 31st, 2013. This compares to $52.5 million as of December 31st, 2012. Cash on hand at the end of 2013 was $27.1 million compared to $13.4 million as of the end of 2012. We had notes payable of $8.3 million as of year-ended 2013. This compares with $3.3 million at the end of 2012. Also, as of December 31st, 2013, the balance on our revolving credit facility with City National Bank was $3 million. This is net of a $2 million principal payment that we made in December. Total stockholders' equity was $41.2 million as of December 31st, 2013. So that concludes my financial remarks, and I'll now turn the call back over to Rick for some concluding remarks.
Thank you very much, Scott. At this time, we'll take questions about the fourth quarter in 2013.
So, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. And if your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, if you have a question at this time, please press the star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. Our first question will come from the line of Michael Kim from Sandler O'Neill. Your line is open.
Hey, guys. Good morning. First off, just wanted to express our condolences again to everyone at the firm. And then just had a few questions. First, Rick, can you talk about just the breakout of the flows between the high net worth and institutional sides of the business for the quarter, and then any incremental color on new relationships and or institutional fundings that may have hit?
Absolutely, Michael. Thank you for your comments. In terms of relationships, as you know, that's one of the most important metrics we look at because it drives future referrals and also represents potential new flows once the relationship has started. The fourth quarter was particularly strong in that regard. We had ended September 30th with 439 relationships and ended the quarter at December 31st with 483. So those moved up by 44 relationships. On the year, just to give you an example of how substantial that was, we had 55. So a tremendous movement in the fourth quarter of this year. On the flow side, it was one of the best quarters we've had in over 3 years. We had new client accounts, completely new and opened, that had initial funding of close to $242 million. That ranks with one of the best quarters over 3 years. There's some others that come closer or exceed that. The most notable thing, however, about this quarter was that net of all withdrawals and additions, which would include additions from those new relationships, we had positive additional flows beyond that of $126 million. And typically, that is a negative number just because existing accounts, to some extent, as you net it all out, are paying taxes in quarters, they've got other lifestyle purchases, et cetera. That is the first significant positive, large positive net inflow once you net that out in over 3 years. So combined in the fourth quarter, you had, due to those new relationships and net flows, north of $365 million. It's closing in on $370 million for the fourth quarter. Overall, for the year, it was 538 once you net everything out. Also significantly, we had closed accounts of only $2 million in the fourth quarter. That doesn't mean a lost relationship. That just means an account that's on our books had closed. Other outflows would have been netted in that $126 million of net inflows that I suggested. So very strong on that basis. In terms of institutional business, to get to the second part of your question, one of our stronger quarters, a lot of the new business in the fourth quarter was indeed driven by new institutional business. Roger Vogel's equity team has continued to put up superb numbers. against the benchmarks and the peers. As I had suggested at our September 30th call, the pipeline for institutional business was very strong, and we saw quite a bit new business come in the ballpark of just north of $200 million in new institutional business in the fourth quarter.
Okay, that's helpful. And then just following up on the institutional side of the business, it does seem like some pension plans are closer to being fully funded just following the rally in equities, and that might drive some of them to adopt maybe more defensive allocations to sort of immunize their liabilities to a greater degree. So just wondering if you're seeing evidence of that trend from your seat and whether that might impact growth opportunities for institutional equities more broadly.
I think given the demand in particular for capabilities like small cap, which we have and have capacity in, to the extent that that trend is happening, it's not affecting us quite as much because of the, just the underlying need for that asset class, given the capacity constraints on other managers. I can't speak globally to whether that trend is affecting us. I think, obviously, when equity markets run, there is a rebalancing that occurs. But pension plans also need substantial growth, especially in a low interest rate environment, and there are very few places they can go to find it. The only observation I'll really make, since I can't comment with great knowledge on that, is that our existing institutional business pipeline, that is the number of mandates and RFPs that we're seeing and participating in, is as strong as it's been. So we're not seeing a change from at least the opportunity set in front of us.
Okay, and then maybe just a couple for Scott. Can you give us any color on the drivers behind the sequential step-ups in compensation and G&A costs this quarter? Were there any sort of noise or timing issues there? And then, you know, looking ahead, you know, how should we be thinking about sort of these lines in terms of run rates going forward?
Yeah, how you doing, Mike? Yeah, so we are, you know, it's our goal to, you know, manage to approximately around a, you know, 55% recurring cash compensation ratio. And you know, as I had mentioned, for the full year 2013, we did actually, you know, that was our ratio for the year. So there's, you know, in the fourth quarter, there's, you know, inevitably going to, you know, be some true ups to comp and things of that nature. So in the fourth quarter, as we, you know, finalized our numbers for the year, we had a adjustment that was reflected. And like I said, for the full year, 55% was our recurring cash compensation ratio.
Okay. Anything on the G&A?
And on the G&A side, we had, you know, we had a couple of, you know, unusual items, you know, that hit in the fourth quarter. There was a, as I'd mentioned, there was about a $780,000 charge that we had to take related to certain, you know, payments that we're going to make through November of this year to a relative of you know, our former CEO. So that was reflected in the fourth quarter, and, you know, it was unusual in nature. We had, you know, we had some residual professional fees that fell out in the fourth quarter, which dealt with our auditors seeking national consultation just again on the presentation of some of our historical financials because of the two classes and the nature of the structure that we closed on. So, you know, items like that are reflected, you know, in the fourth quarter as well.
Michael, this is Rick. You also asked about run rate. It bears emphasizing that the flows that we've seen in the fourth quarter, of course, drive future revenue. We see very little of that within the fourth quarter itself, so that's a very positive development looking forward.
Got it. And then just one final question. Thanks for taking all my questions here. Anything on fee rates? It looks like the blended management fee rate ticked down this quarter, so just wondering if there was any noise that may have impacted that calculation.
Which calculation? Just to be clear, when you said impacted that calculation.
Just the sequential decline in the fee rate, so the management fees as a percentage of AUM.
I think that's probably more a timing issue as anything. The total change in discretionary AUM over the year was up 10%. That drives most of the fees, but our revenue, as you saw, was up a fair bit more than that for the year. I think it was up 16%. So it was not proportional if you look at the full year, and I think that may be more timing than anything. We're not seeing fee pressure any different than we've seen before. I wouldn't ascribe any significance to that whatsoever. As we've mentioned before as well, our large family mandates really have very similar pricing to that we get from our institutional business.
Got it. Okay. Thanks for taking all my questions.
Sure thing.
Thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Stephen Schwartz from Raymond James Associates. Your line is open.
Good morning, everybody. Michael got a lot, but I do want to go back over the account roll. Rick, was the $200 million the institutional business, was that included in the new client account assets of $242 that you cited?
It's included in the total of basically 538, rounding to, let's just call it $540 million, because that's the 242 I mentioned is just the amount that initially gets funded as a new account. But there are a lot of other cash flows. And so we had a net for the year of 540, a net for the quarter of, call it, $368 million. So that the 220 is buried in that number and includes net outflows from other institutions or clients. So it's
okay,
very significant, but not as big a piece of the pie as it might appear if you just take the 242.
So it's 220 of what total? 540.
220 of 370 net inflows.
Of 370 of net inflows.
Yeah.
Okay. And some of that 220 is new, and some of that 220 would be spread over existing accounts. Am I understanding that right?
That 220 is absolutely new business.
It's totally new business.
Yeah. All
right. All right. Let's try this again then. So, new client, brand new client account assets, new families, and new money from institutions was how much in the quarter? Do you know?
So, I think maybe I can't give you quite that granularity. Here's why. We look at $242 million in initialized new accounts.
Right.
Okay. However, we look at net cash flows in and out of the business as well.
Right.
That net number, as I said before, is $126 million.
Right.
I don't break that out much further. For example, that could be $250 million in money coming in, you know, and then subtract out some outflows to get to $126. So the additions, which would include that $220 from institutional, it could be diminished by the outflows on the net side. So basically what I'm saying is look at the 370 total. That includes
right.
some outflows. The 220 new is within that.
All right. Okay, then let me ask this. And what are you defining as a relationship you had? And maybe they just haven't been funded yet, but 439 at the end of the quarter going to 483 at the end of the year. You know, that's call it round number of 40 of
yep. That's
of new
right.
relationships. You know, I think your typical account is somewhere around $30 million. I mean,
so our typical account is much lower than that if you look at a median.
Okay.
The average, you're correct, is now at about $32 million. It's been pretty consistently in that range for years. But an average is skewed higher by the significantly larger relationships.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, right, so you know, our median, especially on the high net worth side, is in the teens.
Okay.
And the way we look at a new relationship is to get rid of noise of small family-related accounts, relatives of the, let's just say, the primary relationship or principal, or an account that hasn't really built to anything substantial. We try to measure somewhere around 95 to 100% of our business with the relationships. And the way we do that is by counting relationships that are in excess of $2 million. So you've got funding issues, you have size issues in there, and you had people, especially with growth in the markets, you had some relationships that reached that threshold and are now being counted. But that's good. They're growing with us or adding money that makes them appear on our screen as a relationship.
Okay. And then one more off of the numbers. Recently, there have been some articles talking about family offices participating in other types of investing, either in you know, holding direct commodities or even hiring former private equity people for families to invest together in companies. Any thoughts on those?
So, you know, the single family offices that may have two or three partners often have become wealthy due to operating businesses, and they're very comfortable continuing to invest in those kinds of deals. We, first of all, have a commodities capability here at the firm that we acquired a couple of years ago for clients who are interested in physical assets of that type. We have not seen a particularly strong desire among our client base heretofore for significant private equity or real estate. For one, many of our clients have made substantial money in private equity and still have substantial holdings that they have brought into Silvercrest that we are monitoring. In fact, there's a fair bit of our non-discretionary assets consist of private equity that we're looking after for our clients. The liquidity scare that occurred during the crisis 5 years ago, it's hard to believe it was half a decade, in addition to the amount of private equity some of our larger clients already have, means that this has not been an asset class that we've really been driving or looking at for our clients, mainly due to demand. However, I think the articles looking at that trend are correct, especially for the smaller family office organized around one or two families. And I think with time, as those private equity investments roll off, and with time, as the liquidity issues of the crisis recede in memory, there will be more possibility and desire for those kinds of relationships here at Silvercrest as well.
All right, great. Thank you, guys.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. And as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. Our next question will be coming from the line of John Dunn from Sidoti. Your line is open.
Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. We'd also like to express our condolences as well.
Thank you very much.
Can you talk about just in 2014 some of the you know, sources of organic growth on the discretionary side, be it, you know, your newer offices or just in general, some of the sources of organic growth?
Sure. I think it's not going to look substantially different from the past, although I think that, as I've stated before, I think some of those avenues of growth kind of represent an option on the existing business for investors. One driver, I think, clearly is going to include the institutional business. We started making an investment to build that business several years ago, and it was right in the midst of the crisis, really, and coming out of it, and we slogged long and hard to build it. It really started coming to fruition a couple of years ago and is building quite a bit of momentum, as we see from the fourth quarter and the results of last year. As I mentioned earlier, the pipeline is very strong. I think we will continue to see good organic growth from that business. In fact, I didn't mention it, but I will now. I think we'll put out a press release soon, if not today. But Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, which has our equity capability on its platform, has moved our small-cap capability onto its focused list, which is a recommended list for their advisors to use. And we have, we've been on the platform, but it's great to be on the focus list and recommended. That could represent meaningful flows. We have invested, as I think you saw a week ago, in a new team in Virginia to bolster our efforts there. Very high-quality people, very deep connections, in particularly the Southeast, with institution and ultra-high-net-worth investors. I think we will continue to make investments in people. And in fact, some of the comp investments we made last year that moved comp from, say, 54% cash to 55% represented some hiring of people who are just starting to build revenue and new relationships, which I expect to catch up on the high-net-worth side. We will continue to make those investments and grow on the high-net-worth side as we have. Finally, there's the growth of new cities and efforts in other places. That's most likely to be done through acquisitions. And as I've mentioned before, we are continually meeting with companies and having discussions. That remains true today. I haven't been asked this question, which I have been asked in the past, which is, how is that pipeline looking? It's actually picked up over the past quarter. There are more opportunities coming to us, and we've had more introductions made, which is good. I think that has something to do with the visibility of the company, which has increased over the past year or so, in addition to what's happening in the marketplace. I think people are feeling good about their valuations in general and are willing to talk. The final piece of potential growth outside of the institutional high net worth business is the risk management, risk reporting, outsourced due diligence work that and capability that we have with our team that we acquired last April with expertise in alternatives, the former sub-advisor of our own fund of funds. That group and that team, their revenue is growing. It is quite small when they joined us, but part of the reason that on the year revenues picked up more than total discretionary assets is because they also have been increasing a bit. It's going to take a while before that effort moves the needle for the company, just because of the low base they're at, but I think in terms of how it's extended our intellectual capabilities here and what we can present to families and institutions, it will help on that side, but they have their own growth that I'm looking forward to promoting.
Great. Thank you for laying that out. Second question was, do you have a thought about how much cash you guys need to retain on the balance sheet to run the company versus excess?
I'll leave that to Scott.
Yeah, I mean, one of the strategies that we've had since going public is that we're managing cash in such a way to set aside the IPO proceeds for future strategic initiatives, and really considering that as a separate pool of money. So, and then the balance of our cash flow, which is, been consistent with our policy over several years, is what we're using to run the day-to-day business. But again, what I can comment on this is we view the proceeds from the IPO as for strategic initiatives.
And then my last question just was, could you maybe talk about that look for performance fees in 2014?
Our view on performance fees is, their inherent volatility. It's not something that, we've historically, projected because of their nature. Also, historically, the lion's share of our performance fees crystallize annually. So you really have to wait till you get to the end of the year to have you know, good insight as to what potentially could crystallize. So.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, John. Thanks, John.
Thank you. Our next question will be coming from the line of Steven Schwartz from Raymond James Associates. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. Just a couple of follow-ups. Rick, the institutional monies that you noted, the 220 or whatever it was any of that CalSTRS? Has that fulfilled its mandate yet? What's the story there?
Let's see here. No is the answer. Just making sure before I answered you. And you know, they would rather us not comment. In fact, they don't even like us talking about the fact that they are an investor. The reason it's out there is because they themselves have revealed it, and they themselves have revealed what they might potentially fund. In deference to their desires, I won't comment on it other than to say we haven't seen additional flows from it at this time.
All right. What are total institutional assets these days?
Let's see here. It is, as of December 31st, 14% of discretionary AUM. I'm sorry to give you a percentage, but I'll figure it out for you.
No, I can do the math. Thank you.
So, yeah, 14%, which is up from 11% as of September 30th of discretionary AUM. And the discretionary AUM as of 12/31 was almost $10.1 billion, up from, call it, $9.17 billion.
Right. Okay, and then just going forward, you know, compensation has been dialed in at 55%, but as the institutional pie grows, right, that comes down or should come down. Is that correct?
So it could. You know, we look at the overall business at 55 cash. You have to support people who build that business and people who work hard on it. I think for a company in our business that's hovering around that 55% cash point is very prudent. We're going to make investments as well, as I mentioned, which makes it hard to look at on a normalized basis. As I mentioned, if we hadn't made any investments in people who can drive new business last year, it would have been at 54%.
Right.
And so you kind of have to separate the two. Yes, there's a potential for that to be driven down as that business grows. But I can tell you that it's at a stage where we have enough clients. We have enough new opportunities. The head of that marketing effort is, you know, very filled up with travel and where he's at. It's likely we'll have to hire a junior marketing executive in that group. So you're going to have periods where we go ahead a little bit with comp to make an investment to really grow the business, and periods where it gets dialed back as that business comes in.
Sure.
And I think at the size of company we're at, it's going to take us a while for that to really normalize. It's going to be some volatility there as we grow, which is a good thing.
All right, and then one more. Early days yet, but how's performance year to date? It looked like it was great last year.
Yeah, excellent. We're hanging in there just fine.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. We'll wait to see if we have any further questions.
Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone, for joining us for our fourth quarter call on 2013 results. I appreciate the questions and your time. Thanks very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude the program, and you may all disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.